This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So, as we all know, few areas of science are more charged with political controversy and public misunderstanding than climate change. After record droughts in the U.S. last year and a growing number of extreme weather events, there's some indication that public concern over the issue is growing. But scientists' uncertainty about climate models, often deliberately exploited by skeptical deniers, is still a powerful source of public confusion, distrust, and misunderstanding. And the fact that many of those who dispute that human activity has a key role in climate change are themselves scientists, though not necessarily experts in climate science or related fields, is also an important factor in public skepticism. After all, if the scientists themselves disagree, how can the average person, let alone the poor journalist, sort out this complicated and often contentious field? Today, I'd like to explore how NOVA has taken on the challenges of communicating climate change to a mass audience and how that approach has evolved over the past few years. You may not agree with how we dealt with these challenges, but as we try to make sense of the issues in ways that the non-scientists can understand, we've learned some lessons that may apply beyond the world of the PBS documentary. So first, let's have a quick taste of some of the problems. Take a look at this promotional clip for a documentary about global warming. No, that wasn't a promo for an upcoming NOVA, I'm happy to say. This was a special called The Great Global Warming Swindle that aired on the UK's Channel 4 several years ago, where it captured a very large audience. The program's publicity materials charge that man-made global warming is a lie and the biggest scam of modern times. And the program itself seems to take pleasure in a deliberately contrarian and self-consciously provocative stand. Following complaints by distinguished scientists about the show's many inaccuracies, the UK equivalent of the FCC held a year-long inquiry into whether the show had deliberately misled the public. And the whole episode stirred up intense debate in the UK press. Now, whatever you may think of the way the media handles global warming, one thing this clip did succeed in doing is satirizing the standard gloom and doom approach of a lot of TV shows on climate change. In this approach, you see stock footage of hurricanes, floods, and natural disasters all strung together to create a mood of impending catastrophe. And that raises an important question. How necessary or desirable is it to scare the pants off the audience in order to get them engaged with the issue of climate change? Does scaring viewers turn them on or turn them off? And does it get in the way of understanding the science? Before I try and answer that, I'd like to spend a moment on the basic nature of television. It's a highly emotional medium that depends on dramatic storytelling. TV shows, even ones about science, have to follow the rules of good storytelling with beginnings, middles, and ends, and definite outcomes. Good television also demands strong visuals and action scenes to capture the viewer's attention. And more important, television is a voluntary activity. Much as we like to, we can't strap people down and force them to watch. So to appeal to viewers, a program simply has to have some entertainment value. Now, contrast that with the nature of climate change, a largely invisible, long-term problem that's inherently uncertain. As the journalist Andy Revkin commented, I can't imagine anything harder to cover than global warming on television. Moreover, it's a difficult and depressing topic, anything but entertaining. It resembles medical subjects like cancer and Alzheimer's disease, which deliver bad news that most viewers just don't want to hear. In fact, conventional wisdom within the TV industry equates most environmental topics with bad ratings. The problems are compounded by the rapid changes of today's media landscape. In a 500-channel world, it's increasingly harder for broadcasters to grab and keep their audience's attention. The nuances of science are likely to get lost as networks shout louder and pace their shows ever faster to capture viewers' eyeballs. And there's a riot of opinion out there. Where there were once just a few trusted sources, now there's an exploding jungle of online news sites, blogs, and websites. Anytime you surf YouTube for videos on global warming, you'll find a chaos of ideas and opinions, with the shrill voices of denial usually prominent. With so many obstacles to clear understanding, how does NOVA set out to make it easier for TV viewers to absorb science without boring, confusing, or misleading them? How can we mix entertainment and serious reporting without dumbing down the science? Starting in 1983, NOVA has made more than a dozen hour-long documentaries on climate change. NOVA programs were among the first to report in depth on global warming, and you can tell by the titles that our earliest approaches were ominous, with programs like The Climate Crisis back in 1983, Hot Enough for You in 1989, and Warnings from the Ice in 1998. So let's take a look at that first NOVA all the way back in 1983. In this clip, you'll see a startlingly youthful Al Gore. He sounds what has become a depressingly familiar complaint about the lack of political will to address the problem.
Is whether or not our elected officials can solve a problem like this, a problem you can't see, that crosses international boundaries and demands long-range planning.
The biggest problem that anyone in the Congress has in addressing a problem this big is that it seems so remote from our everyday experience that it doesn't appear to justify a visceral political response that says, let's do something about it. It seems too remote. However, our industrial civilization has reached the stage now where we evidently can have global effects, and those effects can take place over a long period of time. And in order to stop them, you have to act early on. So we have to deal with a greater amount of uncertainty than we have in the past.
Today, uncertainty permeates all sectors. Scientists recognize the urgency for more and better data. Policymakers face limited options due to national and international political realities. But to retard the CO2 buildup, however slowly, seems essential. It would seem, then, that alternatives to fossil fuels must be explored, even though the safety and costs of substitutes like nuclear or solar power pose difficulties for their future use. International agreement also seems essential to control the use of fossil fuels. But how that can be implemented and enforced remains one of the great challenges of our generation. It appears that a serious policy of more efficient energy use is already economically justified. And in the light of the CO2 problem, such conservation becomes imperative.
So if politics hasn't changed...
The challenge is whether or...
If politics hasn't changed much, the style of TV certainly has. Did you notice how much information the narrator stuffed in for that single interminable shot of the dump truck? Not only is television today much faster paced, but we avoid bombarding the viewer with lots of information over essentially irrelevant wallpaper images. On NOVA, we try not to lecture the audience, but whenever we can, show science in action through process and experiment. Another thing that's changed is the general approach to global warming. In 2006, NOVA aired a show called Dimming the Sun, which explored the uncertainty in climate models created by aerosol pollution in the atmosphere. The upshot was that the heating of the Earth might be even worse than current models predict because the cooling effect of air pollution had not been taken into account. We began the show conventionally enough with a prologue that aimed to engage the viewer with scary images and worrying predictions of a hothouse world. Let's take a look.
When we decide that we want to show
them. He warned us more than 25 years ago that human activity was changing the Earth's climate. Since then, the world has gotten hotter, and NASA scientist James Hansen's warning has been echoed by the vast majority of climate scientists everywhere.
Global warming in the past century is about 0.8 of a degree Celsius, with most of it occurring in the last 30 years.
And now, the warnings have become more urgent.
I don't agree that we've passed a point where there's no hope. but on the other hand, we're darn close.
Close because scientists have uncovered a new factor that may be masking the full impact of global warming. Called global dimming, it's powerful enough to alter temperatures in a matter of days. It may have contributed to the world's deadliest drought. And it could mean that the Earth's climate is about to start heating up as fast as the most dire predictions.
I think we have less than a decade to avoid passing what I call point of no return.
What will the future of our planet be now that we're dimming the sun?
But the program takes a very different path from there. We positioned it as a scientific mystery, drawing the audience in with an intriguing finding. After 9/11, when airline traffic was halted for several days, the reduction in air pollution was found to temporarily affect temperatures all over the U.S. But this was just one mystery among many. With several twists and turns, the story proceeded to trace how scientists discovered that many forms of air pollution, not just that caused by airplanes, blocked the sun's rays, causing less sunlight than expected to reach Earth. Those findings eventually led scientists to conclude that the role of air pollution in climate models had been drastically underestimated, masking the true impact of climate change. By taking the approach of a scientific detective story, Dimming the Sun was a show that not only won a major environmental journalism award, but also secured respectable viewing figures. The lesson here is that one way to get people to watch a climate story is to treat scientific uncertainty as a strength, not a liability, by showing the scientific process in detail and laying out an intriguing trail of clues. Still, climate change remains a challenging topic for us, and our producers have worked hard to find new ways to present it to our viewers. With some limited success, we've tried to take a more upbeat approach, emphasizing the potential economic boon of a green economy in shows such as Saved by the Sun and Power Surge. We even brought in Click and Clack, the popular hosts of NPR's Car Talk, to explore the car of the future.
In a country where gas costs almost $8 a gallon, Iceland's dream is to stop importing oil by replacing conventional cars with hydrogen vehicles, if and when they come to market. In the meantime, a small fleet of buses has been warming the population to the new technology.
This is a nice bus, but it's a bus.
It's just a bus.
Oh, yeah, no, there's nothing different about it except that it's a fuel cell bus, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, but it sounds the same as a bus.
No smell, though, you notice that?
No smell.
No smell, which is very nice, especially in the city.
There's a little smell, but I think it's you.
No, no. Well, we're curious, when we go back to the station, can we see you refuel the bus?
Yeah.
Is there a brick wall we can stand behind?
Like gasoline, hydrogen is volatile stuff. Remember the Hindenburg? That disaster almost ruined hydrogen's reputation for good. But at the world's first public hydrogen fueling station, it's stored safely in pressurized tanks. Let's hope so, anyway.
All right, wait a minute now.
Wait, I want to get a look at this.
Wait a minute. Okay, go ahead.
We're not afraid.
Really?
No.
Look at Chicha Chicha.
Pressurized hydrogen is pumped into storage tanks on the roof of the bus, where it's combined with oxygen in layers of thin membranes called fuel cells. Hydrogen atoms are broken apart, releasing electrons that flow through a circuit, providing electricity that propels the bus. The only emission is water vapor. Iceland prides itself on helping to improve this technology by testing it every day.
You go to a small society like Iceland, where a lot of things are simpler than in a big society like the US or Europe. You can actually test the things out here. That's actually how we think we can help the world.
But our greatest
in a country where gas
and NOVA's most widely watched show on global warming was a spectacular high action adventure. In Extreme Ice, we and our co-producer National Geographic followed the exploits of acclaimed photographer James Balog as he documented the melting of Greenland's glaciers. His quest leads him into some pretty hair-raising situations.
Balog wants to get a shot that delves deep into the underbelly of the ice. The only way to secure his ropes is to thread them through the ice sheet.
You know, this ice sheet is cooking down, melting a lot, so this whole top foot and a half where you would normally put an ice screw is rotten and loose. Whereas here, we're actually using the ice sheet itself and the strength of the ice to anchor the ropes. So, here we go.
All right, a little slack.
Okay. Wow. Yay, how about that?
These giant holes, called moulons, are thought to bore thousands of feet through the ice to the bedrock. But nobody has ever been down there to find out.
Oh, God. That's the first time I've really seen the hole down there. This whole balcony could go any second. There it goes! It's a strange, evil, gorgeous, horrible, fantastic place.
Wow, I mean, there's hundreds of years of ice here layered in, and we're looking into the cross-section of this life history of the glacier. And it's so beautiful, this insane aquamarine and all this scalloping and fluting from the water. What a spot.
Balog is just scratching below the surface of the ice sheet. Below him is another half mile of solid ice. These compressed layers of the ice sheet, there are clues to how fast Greenland could melt.
Through compelling visual evidence, Balog's time-lapse photos of shrinking glaciers, this show brings home the reality of the rapid warming of the Arctic in a way that anyone can understand. Just as important as Balog's infectious, at sometimes seemingly reckless, passion for his project. The success of Extreme Ice suggests how important strong central characters are to reporting on complex science themes. We're fortunate that in climate science there are many gifted communicators, and there's plenty of experimentation and action to provide strong visuals and illuminate the scientific process. Despite all this, commercial pressures in the networks and cable channels have made climate change a sensitive and largely ignored topic. For example, David Attenborough's multi-part blue-chip documentary series, Frozen Planet, was a hit for the Discovery Channel. Although it devoted an entire episode to Arctic warming, the series failed to include any mention that human activities are contributing to the process. As activist Bill McKibben wrote, it was like showing a documentary on lung cancer and leaving out the part about the cigarettes. Until recently, a similar silence reigned in the political realm. Despite last year's record drought and wildfires, not a single journalist posed a question to the candidates about global warming in the presidential debates leading up to the 2012 election. Then came Hurricane Sandy, which struck in late October, and some of the apocalyptic scenarios that environmentalists had warned about for years suddenly became a reality, with death and destruction decimating parts of the Northeast. NOVA's response was a program made in just 3 weeks called Inside the Megastorm. In some ways, this was a classic disaster film, filled with eyewitness accounts and harrowing tales of survival. But it also presented a blow-by-blow anatomy of the storm and an explanation of how a prediction made by a European supercomputer model beat out two American models to prove remarkably accurate days before Sandy made landfall. And it was different from similar programs on commercial cable networks in one distinct way. The program did not shy away from exploring the possible impact of climate change and sea level rise on Sandy or future hurricanes. Let's take a look at the excerpt.
Was this truly a once in a 100-year storm, or is it the beginning of things to come? Did global warming influence the path or severity of this nearly unprecedented storm? Experts agree that Sandy followed a highly unusual track. Typically, the powerful jet stream pushes hurricanes eastward and out to sea. But Sandy turned hard left and headed west into the most densely populated region of the continent. One obvious culprit was a strong high pressure system over the Atlantic, associated with a disturbed and wavy jet stream.
With a wavier jet stream, it's easier for a storm to stagnate or even turn towards the west, towards the coast, which is what happened with Sandy.
The shape of the jet stream is influenced by the temperature difference between the warm atmosphere at the Earth's equator and the cold air at the North Pole. But Arctic temperatures have been rising twice as fast as temperatures over the rest of the globe. And some recent studies have found an association between a wavier jet stream and those rising temperatures. So did a warmer Arctic set the stage for Sandy to turn? Most scientists say it's too soon to know for sure.
What we can say, though, is that there's a lot of evidence suggesting that if you remove ice from the Arctic, you see a wavier jet stream of the type that makes it easier for weather systems like Sandy to turn towards the west instead of getting deflected towards the east.
Right now, we can't blame Sandy's fateful turn directly on global warming. And neither is it clear whether global warming is affecting the frequency of these destructive storms. As some models show, any relationship between global warming and hurricanes is complicated.
And in those models, what happens as the climate warms is that the number of hurricanes actually is more likely to decrease than increase. But at the same time, the hurricanes that there are become more intense. So right now, our models are predicting that hurricanes in a warmer climate will become fewer but more intense.
But there is one undeniable factor that does relate directly to global warming and contributed to Sandy's destructiveness. Sea level. The water in the ocean is warmer than it used to be, and warm water takes up more volume. Warmer seas are higher seas. Add to this melting ice at the poles.
What we do know is that as the climate warms, the sea level will rise. It's already risen around a foot in the last 100 years in the New York area. We don't know exactly how fast the sea level will rise, but we know for certain that it will rise. It could be as much as several feet in the next century.
So in this movie, we saw no contradiction between a compelling disaster movie and a careful analysis of scientific uncertainty. The link to climate change and sea level rise was in the third act of our film, and there was no significant decline in viewership as the hour proceeded. Inside the Megastorm was one of our most popular shows of the season, with ratings 3 and 4 times as high as the competition, which barely mentioned the link to sea level rise and possibly to climate change. Andrew Friedman, a senior science writer for Climate Central, has called Sandy a game changer, which has brought climate impacts and climate risks into the conversation in ways that they had not been considered before. It will be interesting to see whether this will make viewers more responsive to future programs on global warming. So to sum up, we've learned that our viewers can identify with experts who are skilled at explaining what they know and what they don't know. We think the appeal of the traditional gloom and doom approach is limited, and that stories of scientific discovery and ingenuity are important tools of engagement. Even when covering dramatic events like disasters that are partly climate-related, we don't have to sweep scientific uncertainty under the rug, but make it part of the story. And we all know that the urgency of climate change is no excuse for a worthy but ultimately unexciting television documentary. The normal rules of program making prevail: good storytelling, strong visuals, sympathetic and passionate characters. We'll be making a follow-up to Inside the Megastorm next October, stressing the aftermath of Sandy and looking at ways to cope with increased sea level rise in the future. We'll have a better idea then of how tolerant our viewers will be of our efforts and how likely it is that programs like NOVA will help bring climate change more fully into our national dialogue. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That was really, that was very entertaining and educational, just like a NOVA program. And I'm not somebody who does science communication. I just study it, and there's actually a big difference. So I think, though, what I'm saying is by no means an alternative to the perspective of my co-panelist, Paula. I see it as a complementary one. I'm going to address how essentially the science of science communication can be used to improve the efficiency of communication of science relating to sea level rise. But what the science of science communication has to say is going to be something that will be used by professional communicators. The professional communicators are the ones who are going to be able to understand how to use the kinds of findings that somebody who's doing the kind of work that I'm doing can provide. And so I'm going to say what it is. I think that evidence I'm familiar with from my own work and from the work of others can help people who are the professional communicators decide how to do the job of engaging people with climate science on sea level rise. But then you're going to have to tell me what you think the evidence I presented actually entails. What would you do with it? Don't ask me, because I'm not the communicator. But I'm going to give you information that I think is relevant to what you're doing. And then if it is relevant and you have ideas about what to do with it, then I'm going to help you, too, to kind of measure and assess whether the kinds of intuitions you have informed by professional judgment are actually working. And I think that's the kind of relationship between the sort of work I'm doing and what Paula does. I'm going to address the issue of the communication of sea level rise science as an instance of what I'm going to call the science communication problem. And by the science communication problem, I just mean to refer to the failure of widely accessible, valid, compelling science to quiet public controversies over risk or related kinds of policy consequential facts to which that science directly speaks. Now, climate change is obviously the most conspicuous example of this, but it's not singular. And in fact, the kind of methods that I use in my work originated in the study of the gulf between public understandings of the risks of nuclear power and expert understandings. I mean, what was causing the National Academy of Sciences to pull its hair out in the mid-1970s, early 1980s, was that the public seemed to think that the risks of nuclear power are greater than what scientific consensus believed. And so that was the kind of beginning of the empirical study of how is what's known by science made known to people who have to use it. And so I'm going to address the science communication problem. I'm going to start by giving you an account of what I think the problem isn't, and then an account of what the problem is, essentially, and then connect those to the question, what to communicate about sea level rise. All right, so to start with what the problem isn't, I'm going to call this the public irrationality thesis. This is actually, I think, by far still the conventional dominant understanding of why there's conflict about the science on climate change. It's many social scientists will still say this, but clearly you pick up any public opinion magazine, newspaper, the internet. This is the kind of claim that you'll hear, that there's a kind of deficit in public comprehension of science. The members of the public don't know a lot of science, so it's hard to understand what the climate scientists are saying. Or maybe they're easily misled or manipulated, too, by those who want to confuse them. They also don't think like scientists. Right? Scientists think in a kind of analytic, conscious, reflective, slow way, Kahneman would say, a system, too, whereas members of the public think in a more emotional, visceral, rapid, heuristic-driven system one fashion, what Kahneman would call it, the fast way of thinking, and the airplane fuselage that's on fire sticking out of a building and smoke and people jumping out. That's much more gripping, right, than the polar bears are floating away on the ice. And so people end up overestimating the actual harm or danger that they face from these more compelling, gripping risks relative to the more remote, less compelling ones like climate change, which might, in fact, from an actuarial sense, be larger. That's not a silly claim. It's based on valid social science. But more things are plausible relative to the kinds of things we know about human psychology than are true, right? And so the whole point of engaging in empirical study is to try to extricate from the kind of vast sea of plausible explanations which ones really seem to be getting to the heart of the matter. So we tested this, that the research group that I work for, we took a large, diverse sample of members of the U.S. public, and we asked them to tell us how serious they thought the risk of climate change was. Actually, on a scale of 0 to 10, and the average was 5.7, which I'm sure you agree is too little. I mean, it doesn't really matter. You're not looking to see what the number is. There's not a right answer. But it turns out that the kind of response that somebody will give you on that scale will correlate really highly, like 0.9, with anything you ask them about climate change, like whether the Earth is heating up, whether humans are causing it, whether it's causing the ice to melt, whether sea level is going to rise, anything they can understand. So it's a kind of efficient way to fix what people's perceptions are and then look at sources of variance. If I can identify the individual characteristics that explain why some people might think that climate change is more of a concern than others, then I can test hypotheses about why the average member of the public, who I'm now centering here at zero, doesn't have as large a concern about climate change as scientists would say that he or she should, right? So what I'm calling the public irrationality thesis, it makes a prediction about what we're going to see. If the reason that the ordinary member of the public isn't as concerned about climate change risks as he or she should be is that that person doesn't know enough science, right? Or doesn't have the kind of capacity to think analytically in the way that a scientist should, then as people become more science literate, as they become better at handling technical reasoning and understanding the kind of evidence that scientists might show them, you would expect them to become more concerned about climate change risk. And so in the study, we measured the science literacy of our subjects using the National Science Foundation indicators. Their standard for this has been used for years to show we're falling behind Afghanistan and so forth. Also, a measure of numeracy, how good are you with quantitative information? And this is a pretty good indicator of whether you're disposed to use the kind of analytic, systematic, slow, system two kind of reasoning that Kahneman would emphasize. Right? So you would see the predictions would be that as those kinds of aptitudes are increasing, people should be more concerned if the public irrationality thesis is right. And that's not what we find. We find that actually people are slightly less concerned on the whole. That's actually a little bit misleading because, well, first of all, it's pretty close to zero, and there's 1,500 people, so I don't even think that the difference between this and zero matters very much. And there's also a reason not to just look at the average. But the real point is that you don't see the kind of upward effect, which is what you would most likely expect to see if the public irrationality thesis were right. So you say, well, that's evidence that is less consistent with the public rationality thesis being true than with it not being true. But there's more evidence, too. But I'm going to leave it at that and go to another hypothesis about what the problem is. I'm going to call it the motivated reasoning hypothesis. And motivated reasoning refers to the psychological dynamic by which people tend to conform their perceptions maybe of evidence that you're giving them, scientific evidence, or maybe the quality of arguments people are making, or the credibility of different advocates, to some extrinsic interest or goal that they have, unrelated to forming an accurate judgment. Right? So they're crediting or discrediting sources of information in some way that's congenial to some other goal. The classic example of this is a 1950s study called They Saw a Game. And the experimenters had the subjects who were students from two Ivy League colleges. And they said, watch the tape of this football game where there were some disputed calls. Now, of course, they had subjects from the other school watching also, right? And all the students from Harvard said, okay, you know, obviously the referee was biased against Harvard. He's calling all these penalties against Harvard. He was letting Yale get away with murder. And the Yale students say, oh, well, you know, he's biased against us and he's letting Harvard. And this is an example of motivated reasoning. Right, so the stake that the students have in kind of affirming their connection to the group, experiencing a kind of solidarity with their institution, is affecting what they're seeing right on the tape. And so one hypothesis, a conjecture, because this is another mechanism that's just generally true, something like this could be going on with people's perceptions of climate change risk or other kinds of risks. In the work that I do, we characterize people's, we come to their cultural outlooks, but just their preferences about how society should be organized along these two dimensions. They're fairly intuitive. If you believe that individuals should secure the conditions of their own flourishing without collective interference or any collective assistance, you're more individualistic, right? If you believe that everything ought to be done for you by the state, you're 47% who believe that, apparently, it's been shown, that then you're more communitarian. If you think that there ought to be conspicuous rankings based on people's social status. You're hierarchical. You don't think people should be able to tell the people what to do based on who they are. You're more egalitarian. And if you take these, the combinations of outlooks that are formed by the intersection, as it were, of these two dimensions of people's preferences about how social institutions should be organized, then you get these different kinds of ways of understanding things, right? World views. These are, in effect, in our study of people's risk perceptions, equivalent to the school membership, right, of the subjects, and they saw a game. We'll say, well, we expect that people are going to form perceptions of risk that reflect and reinforce these understandings. And in fact, there's plenty of study, a lot of it's just survey study, that shows that people's perceptions of risk, like the climate risk and nuclear power risk, will correlate with these kinds of outlooks. So people are more hierarchical and individualistic, tend to be risk skeptical. The egalitarian communitarians more risk accepting. But other kinds of issues too, the divisions on things like gun control, or the impact of allowing gays in the military, or the impact of on children of having gay parenting, various kinds of public health issues too, right? People, different kinds of people have these kinds of collections of different understandings. We're kind of familiar with this. So we're using a scheme like this. Now, here's an experiment that shows how this operates in the domain of climate change, right? So we take, again, a large national sample, and we say, are these people, do you think they're knowledgeable, credible experts on particular topics, right? And they've all gone to, well, at least one's gone to a really good school, and the other one... That's actually in my contract. I think it's really stupid. But I'm always supposed to say, they went to really good schools, on the faculty of elite universities, and member of the National Academies of Sciences, in the relevant disciplines, right? And you say, oh, are these people knowledgeable, credible experts? Would you give them the time of day if you're trying to figure out what the truth was on these kinds of issues? Now, we pick those issues because we know that they divide people who have the kinds of cultural outlooks that we're looking at least along one of the relevant kind of dimensions. We're showing them essentially evidence. I mean, here's somebody who has all these credentials. He has an opinion on this that might be relevant to whether the view that predominates in their group is correct or not, right? But of course, they call it an experimental manipulation, not because we're manipulating anybody, right? No, because we manipulate them, we show half the people that the scientist is taking the position that we would call the high-risk position, that climate change is definitely happening, it's caused by humans, it's going to have a bad effect. The other, taking what we call the low-risk position, that it's not clear yet, the computer models can't be relied on, we need more evidence. Actually taking this out of work of people who have pretty good credentials and books and so forth. Same thing with the nuclear power, the deep geologic isolation of nuclear waste, very, very safe, very dangerous or very safe. The concealed carrying of handguns, it could create crime, but no, maybe it reduces it, because if everybody's packing heat, then we're all on our best behavior. We don't want to upset anybody, right? And we find that then whether the subjects perceive the scientist, admittedly a scientist in question, to be an expert, somebody you would listen to on that issue, depends on very heavily, is he taking the position that is consistent with or at odds with the one that predominates in the subject's cultural group? If the scientist is taking what we call the high-risk position, then all else equal, the likelihood much higher that somebody who's the egalitarian communitarian on all three of these issues is going to say, oh yeah, that's an expert, than somebody who's the hierarchical individualist. But it flips around if the person takes the low-risk position, the egalitarian communitarian. So that's not an expert on this issue, right? Now, this is equivalent to, it's what you would expect if there's motivated reasoning going on, right? These people have these kinds of connections to these groups. We're showing them evidence, you know. Essentially, is this a qualified referee, I guess, but on this disputed issue? And yes or no, depending on whether the person is saying what you would believe the position should be, given what predominates in your group. If this is how people act in the world, I mean, they're not counting the nose of scientists, but they're getting evidence about what these scientists are saying, or maybe evidence about what scientific consensus is, if they're selectively crediting it or discrediting it in ways that reflect the views that predominate in the group. They're going to be polarized. Polarized on the risks, but polarized, too, on what experts believe, which is what the truth is here. These groups aren't saying, one of them, oh, screw the scientists. They both believe that the scientific consensus is consistent with the position that predominates in their group. And they're each right about one-third of the time if we actually use the National Academy, the expert consensus reports as the benchmark, right? I mean, the group that's right about the climate change is wrong on the nuclear. They're both wrong on the guns. You shouldn't believe, there's no basis for believing anything. It's just unclear, according to the National Academy of Sciences. All right. Now, one thing that these groups agree on is that what the weather has been recently is a pretty good, or at least what they think the weather has been like recently predicts whether they think climate change is occurring. This is a robust finding. But one of my co-author on that same study found that their perceptions of what the weather has been recently is not predicted by what the weather has been recently in their local area. It's predicted by their cultural outlooks, you see. So if you feel kind of hot or something, you don't want to turn the air conditioning on, then you just tell yourself something like, well, you know, the death penalty, it really does deter, or something like, you feel cooler, I don't know. It's something like that. So, but in any case, it goes that deeply. And, you know, this idea, you'll know it when you feel it. You know, you'll only feel it when you actually believe it. If you go to Texas, they have fires, right? That's not convincing them that climate change is happening. I'm not going to say everybody in Texas is this way, but some of them are saying, see, I told you this was what would happen if we had tolerance of gay marriage. I mean, I predicted this, and here it is. You can feel it, and as you can feel it, presumably you'll start to believe. Well, but the point is, you don't know what to make of the thing you're experiencing just based on experience of it, right? There has to be somebody telling you what that means. And if you don't accept that, then what you're feeling doesn't have any persuasive force. All right. Now, one last part about this. In this study, too, we looked at the people's cultural outlooks, and we found, of course, there's a lot of cultural variance. But we weren't just trying to say, hey, look, this is so much bigger, you know, than that or something. We wanted to know what the relationship was between these two kinds of influences on people's risk perceptions. You might think that actually this kind of pattern is consistent with the public irrationality thesis, that if people know science, if they can understand it, make sense of the technical evidence, they're going to go with the evidence. If they can't, then they're going to have to go with their gut, right? And that's filled with crap, like what other people believe or something like this, right? And that generates a prediction, too. You would think then that if the cultural outlooks are kind of a heuristic substitute for being able to make sense of scientific evidence, and have combined the two measures here, they scale really well, then people who are more hierarchical individualists, as they become more science comprehending, ought to become more concerned. And more importantly, the big gap between the two groups, it ought to be narrowing, because the people within them who are the most able to comprehend and make sense of science, they ought to be converging, right? And we find that the people who are more egalitarian, communitarian, are more concerned as they become more science comprehending. Not a whole lot more concerned. But if they were any more concerned than they were, they'd be just kind of going crazy. They would be really out of control. They're more concerned about climate change than terrorism, right? They really are. The polar bear is a more compelling image for them. The people who are hierarchical individualists, on the other hand, are less concerned. And so the gap between the subjects who are the most modest in science comprehension is already pretty big. It just gets bigger for people who are better at understanding scientific evidence, who know more science, or the polarization is increasing as the science literacy and numeracy increases. As people kind of know more about what scientists know and think more like scientists, they're not converging on the scientific view. They're just becoming a more reliable indicator of what people like them are like, you see, because they're being even better at forming the view that connects them to people like them, right? And is that depressing or something? Well, is it? But, you know, if something depressing doesn't make it wrong, right? And the whole point of trying to understand something is because if you don't, then good luck in trying to fix it. If what's going on, because what is going on here? If what's going on here is that people are forming perceptions that reinforce their connection to the group, and maybe for lots of good reasons, by the way, the cost of being out of step with your group can be a lot higher than just making a mistake about climate change. It has no impact on your life, actually. Right? But then you want to try to erase the conditions that put somebody in the position of choosing between being who they are and recognizing what the best science is. Can you do that? Right? So, well, actually, take a look at the sea level rise. You cannot run for office in Arizona or Florida or Virginia or West Virginia, I don't know, maybe in one part of California, saying you want to solve problems of climate change. But in all of those states, you have political activity, stakeholder proceedings that are addressed to trying to deal with adaptation, right? And they're relying on the same climate science that people are otherwise skeptical about. So in Florida, right, the state sent in a petition to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission saying, hey, that you better reconsider the license for the Turkey Point nuclear power plant because it was put on a platform that isn't high enough given the most authoritative recent projections of sea level rise, which were the ones in the IPCC report, right? And if you point that out, you know, they say, that's BS. You know, we're not talking about climate change. You know, the same ones Rubio rejects, right? So what's going on here? You see, they are not talking about the same issue as the one they're talking about when it's climate change. Right? Here, they're not engaging the issue as members of contending cultural groups. They're thinking about this as taxpayers, consumers, resource holders, identities that they share. They're getting the information not from kind of icons of these kind of cultural groups, but from their neighbors, from their elected representatives, even from utility companies. And they're talking about something they've been talking about, well, really, since even before they were born. They've had a climate problem in Florida even before, you know, they got there. It was bad climate. How do we deal with the hurricanes? Or how do we avoid being baked to dust in Arizona? They have a language for talking about it, and it's what they always do. They're on the same team there. And that's what you want to communicate to them. And that's what groups like this communicate. And I'll just mention quickly the group on the Southeast Compact in Florida, because I do work with them. And they're doing this pursuant to state legislation signed by the Tea Party governor telling every municipality that it should revise its comprehensive use plan in light of anticipated impacts because of climate change. Why? You know, now, these guys are really good at communicating, I think, right? And I mean, it's not because they have better graphs, although they have some amazingly good scientists, but they're not just more clear about the science than the climate change scientists are generally, right? And even this, I think it's beautiful, but that's not what's doing the work. And it's not really this kind of stuff. I mean, people know all of this already. And in Texas, they just think, you know, that's not climate change, that's what we get, or what they cause to happen here. Here's what they show them. Here, I'm your county commissioner, remember me? Your neighbor, and I'm doing something about this. And look, you know, Mayor Hay even signed the pledge to join on to this. Why? Because the regional groups are talking about what we can do. To do why? Well, we better do something because saline intrusion is affecting the agricultural industry that we depend on a lot. And it's really unfortunate that A1A keeps getting overturned with water and the beach is disappearing in Fort Lauderdale because that's going to ruin the tourism industry. They care about those things. Right? These are the things that they talk about. But you see, that's a kind of talk we're all on the same team. If you're somebody who is on the other side, you can use the same technique. You see, this is a meeting, county plans for rising seas, but a couple of things here. The developers, climate change naysayers are critical, right? I mean, if you're the guy on the beach whose hotel might get knocked down and raised because you have to push the A1A back in, but you don't like that. I mean, the guy who's in a little bit further loves it, right? But you don't like it. So you call 1-800-ASTROTURF, and out comes the Glenn Beck group, right? I mean, seriously, this is not conspiracy theory stuff. Here's the group. And they say, you know, it's like the watermelon, green on the outside, red on the inside. We're educating Florida and America. And they go to the meetings, these public meetings, where people otherwise are getting information about people like you dealing with this because we're on the same team. And it's bogus science, socialist power grab, UN-based man-made global warming agenda that will tangle us up in a nightmare. They're trying to connect it to the very kinds of associations that make it the kind of us versus them, Red Sox versus Yankees motivated reasoning spectacle we see with climate change. So that's a communication problem. And these guys try to push back. Come on, our group isn't the same as whatever you're talking about, Agenda 21. But it doesn't always work, right? So they lose a county commission in their coalition trying to help people engage in a more sensible way with climate change science, right? And the same thing happens out west in these places. I think it's economically driven, but the technique is to try to infect, essentially, the adaptation with the meanings of climate change that drive people apart by making them think that they're members of these different teams. That's a science communication problem, right? And we've got to fix it by showing them what? Showing them that this is the kind of issue and orientation you should have that is consistent with who you are. Because it really is. And the resources are there. Now, how do we do it, right? What's a compelling way? Because these are compelling people to get these images out there, right? That will show these people and assure them that this is the kind of thing that their team is for. Because if it is, then they will trust them to do what they always do, which is make Florida, despite the kind of place that it is, a place where people really love to come and live and have a great vacation, right? And then they're going to be engaging climate change science, and their congressional delegation is no longer going to be blocking. You can see where I'm going with it, right? So that's what I'm telling you. You tell me how to do it, right? That's what I'm saying you want to communicate, and I'll help you to measure whether it's working.
So, should we go up? Let's go.
Yeah.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.